ready for the interview. And if you get a cue live on a laptop, watch what I'm gonna do. Welcome to the show, let them know we got a point of view. Hey, yo, let's have a combo. Say what you feel, be real, that's the motto. Real talk, pronto, Dr. D, PhD, hit an intro. Hold up, wait, gotta be social. Network global, a home for the locals. Gotta be social, network global, a home for the locals.
So VO2 Max, what's the truth about VO2 Max? One of the biggest truths about it is that it is an incredible indicator of decrease of all-cause mortality. Now, you've heard about this plenty of times when you've looked up any research from anyone who's talked about this stuff, whether it's Peter Attia or Mike Joyner or any of those folks who talk about it. But one thing we haven't talked about is accessibility of the testing. Now, the tests can be quite expensive and time-consuming, and often the best results are done in the laboratory. Now, there's other tests that can be done that are, you know, wearables doing that, and other means that are literally just estimates of it, and they may not give you a lot of accuracy when it comes to VO2 max testing for that. So while it's important that we discuss VO2 max testing, your ability to consume oxygen per milliliter per kilogram of your body weight during exercise, it's also important to point out there's an accessibility issue with VO2 max that we need to discuss. And most people are not going to go to their local university, if there is one, or community college, and see if they have an exercise science program or a laboratory where they can conduct this. Or is it going to be conducted because you have to have a stress test, or it's a cardiovascular based event? It can be very expensive. And so the accessibility of VO2 max testing, I think, is a real issue when it comes to actually getting it done. So we could talk about VO2 max testing and how it decreases all-cause mortality, and having a high cardiorespiratory fitness is really important. But it's also important to discuss the accessibility of it. The other truth that I think is really important when we talk about VO2 max is to talk about the genetic aspect of it. So many people who discuss VO2 max talk about improving your VO2 max. But sometimes that improvement's actually not that possible. There is a small percentage of the population, could be 10% or below, that actually can't improve their VO2 max, right? You heard that here. Sometimes you can't improve it. Contrary to what other people may be saying, it is not always an improvable metric that could actually be increased. In fact, the Heritage Family Study, which is a 30-year study that talks a lot about cardiorespiratory fitness and family aggregation over a long period of time, talks about this. Now, listen, this study has flaws to it, like any study, and the researchers in that discuss those things. But one of the things that is pretty clear from the data is that when we take people from the same family members over a long period of time, we standardize the cardiorespiratory intervention, that we many times get a 0 to 93% increase, meaning that some people have the propensity to have a huge jump in their VO2 max. And some people have the propensity to have zero improvement in that. There may be a genotype related to that that is causing that, that there will be no improvement. This isn't to dissuade you from wanting to improve your VO2 max and doing VO2 max testing, but I thought it was important to point out that there's some gap in discussing. There's a gap in discussing this. It's great to talk about VO2 max and talking about, you know, a decrease in all-cause mortality. Incredibly important. Incredibly important. And we should be discussing that. And the leaders in longevity are doing a great job in discussing that, and those folks that I talked about. But we also need to be honest and present issues like accessibility, and also issues that sometimes improvement doesn't happen. Again, this is a smaller segment of the population, but there is a group of people who VO2 max improvement or the training effect doesn't actually help out. Now, the majority wise, yes, you can gain VO2 max testing. You can increase your VO2 max over time. With the training effect. But again, as I said this again, they can be an area where there's not much improvement, okay? But I'd rather people try and give their best effort to improve that. So let's talk a little bit about VO2 max and what are some other aspects to it. The other aspects to it is that it declines over the course of your lifetime. And part of buffering that decline is actually having a training effect to help buffer that, which is really important there. Now, listen, elite levels of VO2 max are incredible. You see this in cross-country skiers, cyclists, things of that nature. You can have 70s, 80s, just incredible VO2 max numbers. You could also have elite levels where you're in the kind of high 50s, 60s. I've had my VO2 max done in a laboratory when the last time I had it done, honestly, was like 25 years ago. I had my VO2 max done. I had it done several times. This is when I was a collegiate track and field athlete. And one time during my, it was exercise phys course, we did it. And then also did it as part of our track and field team. We had everybody come in and do VO2 max, hematocrit, Wingate bike test, YMCA submaximal bike test, all that stuff. And I believe, if I remember correctly, it was a long time ago, that I scored in the high 50s. And so that put me in a really great level, higher than average VO2 max. And I felt great about it. Now, I have no clue what it would be now. I'm training incredibly hard. I definitely get in at least one day a week of significant VO2 max based training. And this, I think, is significant. So I would say, you know, based on doing this testing, which, by the way, is very uncomfortable. The other thing to be told is that doing the VO2 max test, especially in laboratory, besides being potentially expensive, time consuming, it doesn't feel good. And listen, I'm not against that. I'm just saying exercise is uncomfortable. But in this case, you know, having now it may be different now. And who, if you're conducting these tests now, please tell me I'm wrong or say it's been updated. I think the headgear is better than it used to be, but it was very constricting. And then you're getting your nostrils pinched off here and you feel like you're suffocating when you're doing it. And that incline is just going up and up and up until you reach that point where you just can't go any further. So it's a pretty brutal test, but it does provide a very significant outcome and see where you're at. And so I'm a really big proponent of the fact that we really need to spend a lot of time focusing on these types of metrics because I think they're really important. And a lot of doctors and exercise physiologists are talking about that. I just felt it's important to come on and kind of provide even more nuance to it and talking about the accessibility of it and talking about that sometimes there is not an improvement in it. Generally, that is the case. There will be improvement. How much you improve, really based on how much you're willing to do for it. You know, there's a dosage aspect to it that I think is really important. And we need to be understanding of that. But generally speaking, most people, the dosage is underwhelming. The majority of the population is not getting the proper dosage for most exercise. And one thing that we know with people, and this is a great, I think, kind of phrase, and it's fairly true, I think, of just anecdotally, observationally, which is that people often overestimate how much they exercise. They do, and they underestimate how much they eat. But sticking with the food part here, with the exercise part here, people often attribute way more of what they did than what they actually did. So think about it this way. Someone may tell you they've gone and they've done a cardiovascular workout, right? But they more than likely probably fudge how much they actually did, whether it's purposely or they just don't know. But often a lot of cardiovascular exercise is steady state exercise, which is great, which is literally awesome. And you should do that. But very rarely are people getting into a zone that's uncomfortable that is actually helping their VO2 max. You may be helping your steady state cardiovascular endurance, but for a high level of cardiorespiratory endurance, which we know is really important for decreasing all-cause mortality and longevity, you got to push yourself. You know, what I see often at gyms, I'm glad people are there, or I'm glad people are walking and all those things. They're really important. But if you want to improve your VO2 max, it's not going to happen from low intensity exercise or cardiovascular work. It's not going to happen generally from moderate based cardiovascular work unless you're starting at a really low level. If you're anywhere in the moderate range, you're a regular exerciser, you're going to have to push yourself pretty significantly. You're going to have to expand that rib cage. That's a really big thing for me. I really focus on at least once a week, you should be expanding your rib cage. really working those intercostal muscles, those internal, external intercostal muscles that you use in breathing. Be out of breath. Just once a week, really push that. Stress the stimulus. Create a stimulus for your cardiorespiratory system that's going to allow it to improve for you to intake more oxygen for that. So one of our biggest issues, and I think this is the majority of the population, when you look at the data, we're just underdosing. We're underdosing our cardiorespiratory fitness. Now, you may see when you go to a gym, a bunch of people on treadmills and stuff, majority of people on there, the dose is too low. It's way too low. Now, it's way too low for VO2 max based work. It's probably just right if you're looking for steady state, low intensity cardiovascular, like foundational endurance work. Great. A lot of the population that does exercise is getting this when they do cardio. But I would gather, listen, I don't have the data on this, but I would gather 80 to 90% of people in gyms are not actually doing any VO2 max based training at all. And if they actually got it tested in a laboratory, it'd be pretty low. Now, depending on your age, it'd be much lower. So, you know, my challenge to you is, and the people listening to this, is start incorporating more VO2 max training into your program. And listen, I'm not going to give you this huge exercise prescription, things of that nature. You want to get that? Reach out to me. All right. Talk to me a little bit about it. But as a general principle behind it, I'm more for, listen, do something that is going to get you out of breath. Okay. There's lots of different training protocols and different interval-based programs you could do to achieve that. Depending on where you're at, it may be appropriate, not appropriate for you. But don't do something. If you're going to do a steady state exercise, you're already doing that. You got to bump it up. You know, so you need to do something that is going to cause you to feel uncomfortable. The VO2 max based testing is uncomfortable. Training for a VO2 max, increasing it, is uncomfortable. We have to be good with being uncomfortable for that. So, in reviewing this, okay, it's important. VO2 max testing is an accessibility issue. Most people don't even know where to get it done, and it may be cost prohibitive. Other options for that are generally just very low-level estimates. They're not going to give you the best information on that. Two, it's really important to understand that sometimes there's a training effect that won't occur. You may train and really work hard to increase your VO2 max, but there may be a genetic component that will not allow that to happen. Now, that's probably not you, because it's a very small percentage of the population. But it's important to point out that it could happen. It definitely could happen. And three, I think, where the dosage is too low for most people. Now, you could say that there are people out there when the dosage is too high. Sure, a lot of your athletic population or people are just burning out, just crushing workouts constantly too much. Okay, how many people you know are doing that? That's a small percentage of the population, tiny fraction of the population. They are probably getting diminishing returns, pushing too much, not recovering well. This is a problem. But for the majority of the population, the dosage is way too low, certainly for VO2 max based training effect. Last thing I will say here is it's really important to really understand recovery related to this. And I will get into recovery a bit more in another podcast, but doing these types of workouts, they're pretty punishing. They can be brutal, they're very difficult. You're not having conversations with people next to you. You're going to be out of breath. You're going to be heaving. That chest is going to be heaving up and down. That's a good thing. Don't look at it as a negative thing. That's a good thing. You're actually improving and causing a stimulus that's greater than what you're used to. Once a week, give yourself at least once a week that. But it's important to understand after that, some recovery for that. We'll leave that to another podcast for that. But just remember kind of these three things: that there's an accessibility issue, VO2 max. As much as we talk about it, we kind of have to overcome that aspect of it. There's sometimes a genetic aspect or heritability aspect that's not going to allow us to get as high as we maybe want to for that. And three, let's make sure that that dose is at least enough that's causing a stimulus to cause a change, the training effect to change for that. So thank you for listening. I truly appreciate it. And until next time.